From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Americans were held hostage in Iran, Gary Sick was one of the aides who worked closely with President Carter to try to secure their release. Now Gary Sick is convinced that the Reagan-Bush campaign arranged a secret arms for hostages deal with the Iranians, and as part of the deal, the release of the hostages was delayed until after the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Sick about his investigation into the story. It's the subject of his new book, October Surprise. Also today, book critic John Leonard takes a look at The Runaway Soul, the long-awaited novel by Harold Brodkey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The European Community's foreign ministers meeting in The Hague have called for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council to discuss the Yugoslav crisis. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
With the continued failure of the European Community's attempts to solve the Yugoslav crisis, the United Nations is emerging as the focal point of attempts to mediate the civil war. The EC foreign minister's action comes on the heels of a request from the warring republics of Serbia and Croatia to the UN to send a peacekeeping force to Yugoslavia. Tomorrow, former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar's personal envoy in the crisis, and Lord Carrington, chairman of the EC Peace Conference, will travel to Belgrade to discuss the peacekeeping force with Yugoslavian leaders. The UN is involving itself in the crisis in other ways. Today, it was announced that the organization is giving Hungary $3 million to help it cope with the estimated 40,000 Yugoslav refugees that have crossed its borders since the crisis began. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Negotiators for the leftist rebels in El Salvador said today that they'll stay at the bargaining table until they achieve a truce ending the country's 11-year civil war. The leftists are meeting with Salvadoran government representatives in Mexico City. Salvadoran President Alfredo Cristiani has threatened to walk out on the talks because of what he said was a new offensive by the rebels. The rebels have denied any new attacks and have called for an interim ceasefire. The latest round of talks in Mexico focuses on the Salvadoran armed forces, including a rebel demand to prosecute human rights violations by the military. President Bush's nominee for Attorney General today defended the Justice Department's handling of the BCCI investigation. William Barr, currently the acting Attorney General, spoke during the first day of his confirmation hearings. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Barr told Senate Judiciary Committee members that the investigation into the scandal-ridden Bank of Credit and Commerce International had been free of any political interference.
No one at the CIA, the State Department, or the White House, or anybody outside the Department of Justice, as far as I am aware, has ever attempted to influence the course of this case.
Barr defended the department's handling of the investigation against criticism it had gone too slowly. He said the investigation was continuing and that it was unfair to do an autopsy on a live body, as he put it. Barr said he has ordered an internal review of Justice Department procedures to see if any mistakes were made. His answers and assurances during today's first session seem to satisfy most senators. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 12 points to close at 3,054. Advances led declines by a margin of about 2-1. This is NPR. A witness at the trial of Manuel Noriega testified today that Colombian drug bosses tried to contract with to have the former Panamanian dictator assassinated. The testimony came from confessed Colombian drug trafficker Cesar Cura, who claimed that the drug bosses believed that Noriega had betrayed them to American authorities. Cura said that the drug bosses had paid Noriega $5 million for protection and were angry that one of their Panamanian drug labs had been raided by police. Cura said that he helped persuade the drug cartel members not to try to kill Noriega, but to negotiate a new deal with him. Noriega is being tried in Miami on 10 drug and racketeering counts. The White House announced today that President Bush has invited basketball star Magic Johnson to join the National Commission on AIDS. Eric Weiner reports.
White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater told reporters aboard Air Force One that he felt Johnson was, quote, such a role model, he would be an excellent member of this commission. Administration officials have been in contact with agents for the basketball star, and they hope to have his decision in a few days. Fitzwater made his comments while en route to New York, where the president was to appear at a fundraiser. The 15-member National Commission on AIDS advises Congress and the White House on national policy to combat the epidemic. Johnson would fill the vacancy left by Belinda Mason, who died of the disease in September. For National Public Radio, this is Eric Weiner reporting.
Programs to limit the spread of AIDS by distributing condoms in public schools have run into trouble in Massachusetts. The city of Chelsea, next to Boston, is considering such a program, but it's been opposed by school superintendent Peter Greer. Greer said he doesn't oppose giving condoms to kids, but believes that schools shouldn't be the distributors. Boston Mayor Raymond Flynn said that giving out condoms could actually encourage young people to be more promiscuous and thus increase the spread of AIDS. A recent federal study reported that 57% of all high school students reported that they'd had sexual intercourse.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the troubling political questions that won't go away is this. Did the Reagan-Bush campaign make a secret deal with the Iranians in 1980 to trade arms in exchange for 52 Americans held hostage in Iran? And was it part of this alleged agreement to delay release of the hostages until after the inauguration of Ronald Reagan? My guest Gary Sick has come to believe there was such an agreement. Sick was President Carter's chief aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. His new book, October Surprise, is based on his investigation into the alleged deal. In the story, as Sick reconstructs it, the Reagan campaign, led by William Casey, was afraid that Carter might negotiate a hostage release during the final month of the election campaign. This possibility became known as the October Surprise, and the Republicans feared that if Carter won the hostages' freedom, he could win the election. So the Reagan campaign headed off that possibility by making its own secret deal with Iran. Sick concludes his book by saying, the full truth may never be known. So how confident is he that the Republicans negotiated a secret deal?
Well, I've been working on this for about 3 years, and over that time, I have become progressively more confident. Today, after having spent the summer intensively researching and writing this book, I am more persuaded than I ever was that this happened. I don't pretend to know every detail of what happened at every moment. There are gaps and lapses in the story that still remain to be filled in. But in my own view, the coincidences are so astonishing that there is no way to explain them away except the obvious way, and that is that in fact something happened.
Now, Newsweek just ran a cover story that I'm sure a lot of our listeners saw. It was called The October Surprise, The Charge, Treason, The Evidence, Myth. And it describes the October Surprise story as a conspiracy theory run wild. Did any of the information in Newsweek make you question your sources or your information?
Not in the least. The Newsweek article came out just the week before my book was published. They did not have the book when they wrote the story. They did call me, and I was interviewed at some length about some of the allegations that they intended to make and so forth. I gave them quite a long interview. I explained to them what I was doing, the way I used sources and the like. Virtually none of that appeared in the story, and they were in such a hurry to get out that they weren't prepared to wait and read the book, which is perfectly okay, of course, except that in my view, what they ended up with is not so much wrong as simply irrelevant. They are dealing with issues which they've sort of invented a generic believer in the October Surprise story, and then have set up straw men and knocked them down to show that that generic believer somehow is foolish, misled, duped, misguided, or simply not very attentive to the facts. And so they spend a great deal of time knocking down a series of sources that I really don't even use, or that if I use, I use them extremely limited way.
Yeah, and talking about sources, a source that you use is Ari Ben-Menashe.
Yes.
And it's interesting, you know, this is the third book I've read in the past few months where he's one of the main sources, Seymour Hersh's book about Israel's secret nuclear weapons.
Right.
system. He's one of the sources. Andrew and Leslie Coburn had a book about the secret relationship between the U.S. and Israeli intelligence operations. He's one of the major sources for that. A lot of people have tried to discredit him. Everybody refers to him as shadowy. Do you feel confident using him as a source?
I feel very confident in using him the way I have used him, and that is not to say that every word the man has ever said is true or that there aren't some unexplained elements of his past, but I have used very selectively information that he provided me, which I could get from no other source, and which I then went about trying to corroborate. And in each of the cases, I have found at least partial, and in some cases, total. For instance, Ari Ben Menashe told me, and I've spent many, many hours with him, he told me some time ago that Israel conducted a secret arms shipment to Iran back in early 1980, which actually in the same month as the rescue mission. So you had this peculiar circumstance of Israel sending arms to the Ayatollah just about the same time that the United States was launching its rescue mission. Well, I found that just astonishing. I really did. And I said, this just can't be true. So I started checking around, and for a long time I could get no corroboration or no confirmation of it. But finally, I actually got it confirmed by several high-level Israeli sources themselves. They didn't know that they were confirming what Ari Ben Menashe had told me, but they did confirm key elements of his story, which could only have been known by somebody who was really inside the system. So in that sense, I trusted absolutely what he said. Now, that doesn't mean that everything else that he's said is necessarily true, but in this case, I know he was telling me the truth, and I know that for several other elements of the story.
One of the points that the Newsweek article makes is that Casey was supposed to have opened up the deal for the release of the hostages at a meeting in Madrid. And Newsweek says he was actually in London the whole time at a conference, that there's restaurant bills, and attendance was taken at a symposia within the conference, and all of his day is documented. He was in London the whole time.
Well,
what does that do to your theory?
Nothing at all. We actually knew about that.
That he was in London the whole time?
We knew that he was in London, not that he was there the whole time.
Yeah, but you thought there was enough time for him to fly to Madrid.
Absolutely. They have records that they're not as conclusive even in terms of where he was during that period of time. But let's say that during a period of 1.5 days, they have located him at a particular conference center in London. 1.5 days. Casey was gone for 4 to 5 days, and there's nothing in the world that prevents him from having been in Madrid during that period of time. We don't know when Casey flew over to London. It was a weekend. If he flew on Friday night, he had all day Saturday and all day Sunday to be in Madrid before he shows up for the conference on Monday morning. So, and then he was also missing one day at the end of the conference. So at this point, to say that this is conclusive, absolute evidence that Casey could never have been in Madrid is just wrong.
Now, you've said that initially you thought the Iranians waited till after the inauguration of President Reagan to release the hostages just to humiliate President Carter. What was the key moment in convincing you that there may really be some truth behind the October surprise story?
It really was not until I started writing a book. And the book was not supposed to be about this at all. The book was supposed to be about the Reagan administration's relations with Iran. And I intended to focus primarily on the Iran-Iraq war and the Iran-Contra affair. But as I got into it, I realized I had to start at the beginning. And that meant looking at 1980, the elections, and the effect of the hostage crisis on U.S. relations with Iran. The more I got into that, and the more I began digging, the more I became convinced that there were things here that just had not been explained before. And as I worked on the subject, my initial subject gradually disappeared, and this took over full time. And there probably the most important single moment for me, although there were lots of moments when I gradually became more and more persuaded, was when I sat down in London in the office of Jamshid Hashemi, an Iranian businessman, arms dealer, intelligence operative, and now American citizen as of a few weeks ago. and sat down with him in London, and he began describing to me his participation in a meeting with William Casey in Madrid in July 1980, in which Mehdi Karoubi, who is the man who is now the Speaker of the Parliament in Iran, sat down and they did a deal. And that was a revelation to me, because nobody, in all of the discussions of this issue, nobody had ever previously mentioned meetings in Madrid, Mehdi Karoubi, or any of this. It was all brand new information. Needless to say, I was, one, startled, but also very skeptical. And so I began taking his story apart and going back and looking for confirmation. And it turned out that everything he told me, I have found not a single piece of information that disconfirms anything that he's told me so far. So that was dramatic.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gary Sick, and he was an aide to President Carter at the time of the Iranian hostage crisis, and he's one of the people who worked closest with Carter in trying to negotiate their release. And Gary Sick has written a new book called October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Gary Sick is my guest, and we're talking about the research that he did in investigating the possible October surprise. Can you spell out the deal as you know it to have existed, the deal between the Reagan administration and the Iranians?
As it was described to me, especially in this meeting in Madrid, they got together on the first day of this meeting, and each side set the tone. Karoubi complained about U.S. policy, about American history, about support of the Shah, and Casey responded by saying basically that when the United States has a Republican president, relations with Iran are good, but when they have Democrats as president, relations tend to be bad. In fact, that was quite accurate. I mean, it may have been exaggerated, but that does tend to be the historical truth. He said he was quite well briefed, and he gave a very persuasive presentation. And really nothing much more of it came of the first day. They met again in this same time period. And in the second meeting, Karoubi said to him, well, what are we doing here? I mean, why did you want to talk to me? And they jostled a little bit more. And finally, Casey said, you know, if you would be willing to give us assurances that the hostages will be treated well and taken care of very well, and will be held by you and that the hostages will be delivered to the Republicans, we will be prepared in turn to make Iran strong by giving it military equipment and political benefits. And that was the essence of it. Karoubi said, well, that's interesting. And privately, he said, you know, we really are dealing here with somebody who knows how to do business, and I think we're on the right track. He then went back to Iran, checked with Ayatollah Khomeini, and 2 weeks later or so came back to Madrid. They had another meeting in which Karoubi confirmed that they would be prepared to do this, but they also wanted to see the color of his money. They wanted to see some arms up front. Casey said, well, we're not in power, so we're not in any position to provide military equipment at this stage, but I have some friends. Let me see what I can do. The next day, Jamshid Hashemi, the man who told me the story in great detail, says that he met with his brother, with an Israeli official, and that they began a shipment of military equipment from Israel to Iran that amounted to at least 4 shiploads of equipment that started probably in about September 1980 and continued on through the end of the year. And that was the genesis of the deal. That's the way I understand it. And then, of course, additional touches and flourishes were put on it as the time went on.
Why would the Iranians have cut a deal with the Republicans as opposed to the Democrats who were already in the White House?
Well, I think that was a close call for them, actually. The principal reason, I believe, is that Carter was not interested in opening up a long-term arms relationship with Iran. Carter said that if the hostages were released, he eventually said, he bargained on this point, but he said if the hostages are released, the United States will return all of Iran's frozen military equipment. This is stuff that was in the pipeline at the time of the revolution, and it was frozen there, and it was just a collection of material. It amounted to about $300 million worth of stuff. It was not insignificant. But that was owned, paid for, and title had already been transferred to Iran. It was their military equipment. That would be returned to them, but there were no promises of anything beyond that, and no under-the-table deals with regard to arms. He also, Carter, took a very, very strong position opposing Israel's interest in selling arms to Iran. The Israelis were in early in 1980 and on through much of the remainder of the year asking if the United States would not go along with a deal where Israel would begin selling arms to Iran covertly and trying to reestablish their contacts with Iranians. Carter simply would not go along with that. So what the Republicans were offering was not just a one-shot affair and then hostility. They were saying, if you do business with us, we'll open an arms relationship with you. We will permit Israel to ship the arms that you want if we can't do it ourselves. And we will promise certain, political benefits. In other words, we'll wink at the embargo. We'll wink at various restrictions that have been placed there in the past and let things happen. And for the Iranians, that was, in many respects, I think, a much more attractive deal.
You said that the Republicans not only had an intelligence operation to get information from the Carter White House about plans to get the hostages released, but also that the Republicans used disinformation. What's an example of that?
Well, the disinformation, in the middle of October, for instance, when they were concerned that Carter might launch a rescue mission, that the Carter administration might try to pull what they considered to be an October surprise, information began to appear on radio and television stations across the country claiming that that Carter was moving military equipment to Iran as part of a secret swap, that the hostages were going to be free any minute, which, first of all, put the White House on the defensive, because the White House had to say, no, we're not doing that. And, of course, it was not happening. I mean, it really was not true. And it also tended to make people believe, which was certainly the political object of this, that Carter was prepared to do anything, so that if he did pull a deal at the last minute, people would say, well, it's all just politics. So instead of giving him credit for getting the hostages out, they would say, this is just more Carter politics, and you could discount the whole thing. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to do in an election. But in this case, it did, in fact, affect the timing and the nature of the negotiations that were underway with Iran at the time. These constant reports that a deal was being done ended up being denied not only in the United States, but also in Iran, and I think to some degree got in the way of the negotiations that the Carter administration was trying to carry out itself to get the hostages out.
Until the last minute, President Carter was negotiating with the Iranians about unfreezing Iranian assets. That's something Carter was willing to do.
That's correct.
And in January, assets were put, money was put in escrow in an Algerian bank to be released when the hostages were released. Now, why were those negotiations between Carter and the Iranians continuing if there was already a deal cut between the Republicans and the Iranians?
Well, the reason was that the original deal was to release the hostages to Reagan. But I think the Reagan campaign and the brand-new Reagan administration, the last thing they wanted was to have the whole hostage crisis dumped into their laps. According to one of the sources who says that he was in Paris during the time of the meetings in October between Casey and the Iranians, he says that one of the that Casey was making it very clear that they didn't want the hostages out until Reagan came into office. And one of the Iranians remarked rather scathingly, well, why don't we just put the whole thing off until, you know, next March or April, and then the Republicans can not only say that they got the hostages out, but they can have the glory of actually going through all the negotiations. And everybody sort of laughed. Well, that was a messy situation. To negotiate with the Iranians meant that you had to deal with terrorists, which Reagan said that he would never do, and that was a primary ideological position of the new administration when it came in, contrary to what they actually were doing, in my view. But there was that he would have also then had to do a deal with Iran, which meant paying them off somehow. And the Reagan supporters were taking the position that Carter was paying ransom to Iran by setting up this escrow arrangement. I disagree with that intensely, and I think it's even the Republicans came to realize that that was not true. But at the time, feelings were running very high. So the best possible arrangement for the Republicans was to have Carter do the deal, work out all the details, take all the political heat for it, and then have the hostages come out and be handed on a silver platter to Reagan. And in fact, that is what happened.
You expected the hostages to be released during the last moments of Carter's presidency, in part because there were negotiations to unfreeze the Iranian assets.
Right.
In the United States. But at the last minute, the Iranians took exception to a clause in the agreement, and things were held up. Do you now think that that was because of the Republican deal?
I really do, because it was a minor technicality. It didn't amount to anything. The Iranians in the previous few days, in just a few days earlier, had reversed themselves in what was really one of the most costly political collapses that anybody has ever gone through in a negotiation. They decided not just to they decided to pay off their loans, not just to bring them current. They had billions of dollars in outstanding loans with U.S. and foreign banks, and there was a big negotiation about how to deal with that. And so they resolved the issue by just paying the loans off in cash. It was a mammoth transfer of funds, and that was basically, that cut the Gordian knot, that broke the logjam and let the negotiations go forward. And it was immensely costly. I calculate in the book, and roughly, that the Iranians paid something like $300,000 a day per hostage during the entire hostage crisis, that is the cost of the hostage crisis to Iran. Well, they had just made this immense concession to the United States and saying, okay, we'll pay off all of our loans at immense cost to Iran. And then they stick on a tiny little technical detail that would have actually had the hostages released a day before Reagan came in. And so they postponed the release for 24 hours, 36 hours, long enough to make sure. And then they said, okay, that is taken care of. And all of the details were taken care of. Everything was worked out. Approval was flashed to Iran, and there was just no answer. We'd been communicating back and forth just minute to minute. Suddenly, there was a four-hour delay that Iran there was no answer. Nobody was talking. And their answer didn't come through until 12:05, which was 5 minutes after Reagan had been taken the oath of office.
Gary Sick is the author of October Surprise. Coming up in the second half of Fresh Air, Sick reflects on the political implications of the story. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our discussion with Gary Sick. Sick was an aide to President Carter during the Iranian hostage crisis. Sick's new book, October Surprise, examines the allegations that the Reagan-Bush campaign made a secret arms-for-hostages deal with the Iranians in 1980, and as part of that deal, the release of the hostages was delayed until after Reagan's inauguration. In this second part of our interview, Sick tells us how his investigation into the story has changed him and his view of American politics. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews The Runaway Soul. It's the novel that writer Harold Brodkey worked on for more than 30 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A passenger ferry making a second effort to reach European community observers trapped in Croatia is reported to have been denied safe passage and ordered to a Yugoslav naval base. Meanwhile, pro-Serbian forces have intensified their assault on Dubrovnik and other cities. Pierre Vickery has more.
Eyewitnesses trapped in the medieval port of Dubrovnik say the city, famous from picture postcards, has ceased to exist. A relentless five-day bombardment by land and sea has left at least 50 dead and more than 300 wounded. Dozens of hotels have been destroyed, hundreds of cars and boats wrecked, and the economic infrastructure of the Dubrovnik region has suffered millions of dollars of damage. City officials say irreparable damage has been done to the heart of the historic city, with churches and monasteries bombed, statues and intricate ornaments riddled with bullets, and the medieval walls breached by artillery fire. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
According to Soviet President Gorbachev, last summer President Bush told him that a coup was in the plotting stage in the Soviet Union. But he ignored the warning because he thought, only in his words, a madman would try to overthrow the Soviet government. The Soviet leader told a news conference today, held to promote his new book about the failed coup, that Mr. Bush had telephoned him with a warning. Gorbachev also said that he believed some of those involved in the coup taped a conversation of his and learned that he was planning major personnel changes. President Bush's former deputy national security advisor, Robert Gates, was sworn in today as the new CIA director. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
Gates' swearing-in concludes what had been a controversial and contentious battle with Congress and many CIA insiders. The president nominated Gates despite allegations that he knew far more about the Iran-Contra affair than he had acknowledged. Later, Gates, a Soviet expert, was criticized for failing to see the warning signs that Soviet communism was collapsing. His critics even claimed that he had doctored intelligence analysis to fit the policies of the Reagan administration. Gates survived those challenges to his nomination. Today, Mr. Bush, who himself was director of the CIA under President Ford, praised Gates, citing his wise counsel during the Panama crisis, Operation Desert Storm, and the failed Soviet coup in August. Gates said the president has my deepest trust. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 12 points to close at 3,054.11. on volume of some 199 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2-1 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Bush, speaking at a campaign fundraiser today in New York City, called for lower interest rates on consumer credit cards. As he roundly criticized Democratic members of Congress, Mr. Bush said that current signals are mixed on the state of the U.S. economy. Earlier this month, the president called on consumers to buy more cars and homes to help stimulate the economy. Organizers said that today's $1,000 a plate fundraiser luncheon added more than $2 million to the Bush-Quayle reelection bid. A bipartisan group of lawmakers has introduced legislation in both the House and Senate, which would extend for another year a dozen targeted tax reductions set to expire December 31st. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Those who benefit from the tax breaks range from self-employed workers seeking health insurance to those who invest in solar and geothermal energy to people who donate works of art to museums. Representative Frank Guarini, a Democrat from New Jersey, said to take the tax reductions away during a recession would be counterproductive. Republican Senator John Danforth agrees.
This is the most non-controversial, bare-bones kind of tax program. But at a time of recession, people are concerned about jobs. This is job.
It's likely that any major tax bill that reaches the floor will become the vehicle for other proposals, such as a capital gains rate reduction or a general tax cut to middle-income Americans. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dan Rostenkowski has been hesitant to extend the tax reductions for fear that a number of other amendments would be tacked on. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The Times Mirror Company says that more than 300 employees at the Los Angeles Times will take early retirement in a program designed to cut expenses. This move means a one-time charge of about $22 million. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Many journalists have been investigating the October surprise story, allegations that the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 negotiated a secret deal with the Iranians to delay the release of the American hostages until after the election. Recently, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee voted to investigate these charges. My guest, Gary Sick, is a former insider who has spent years on the story. Sick was President Carter's chief aide on Iran during the hostage crisis. Now he's written a book called October Surprise. In the first part of our interview, he reconstructed the story of the secret deal as he has come to believe it happened. In this second part of our interview, we talk about what he thinks the political implications are of his findings. Even Sick admits the full truth may never be known, but Sick is convinced there was a secret deal. So what does he think that says about American politics and the state of American democracy?
It's not a very pretty story. It is not one that I felt very comfortable with, in the sense that I've always in the past tended to be relatively nonpartisan. I was not seen as a political activist. I have never engaged in sort of political campaigns or anything of the sort. I guess the simple answer to it is simply that it is politically important. From my point of view, if this is true, as I believe it is, and the Republicans in the race for the White House were prepared to toy with the lives and safety of the American hostages, to undercut their own government in a negotiation with a hostile foreign power, all for temporary but significant political gain. If they do that, and they get away with it, and they win the election, and nobody ever calls them on it, then the word is going to be out in the circles that count that this is the way you do it. It works, it pays off, and that's, you know, anything goes. In my view, politics can be a dirty game, but there are limits. This exceeded the limits of what I would regard to be acceptable political behavior. And for that reason, if this happens, if this sort of thing is done, the American voter is being cheated.
You were one of the people who was most involved with trying to negotiate a release of the hostages. What do you feel? And I'm talking now about, like, emotionally, what do you feel when you think about the possibility, or in your view, the probability that the Republicans negotiated a secret deal?
Well, I approached this, and this may surprise you, actually, but I really approached this as a research project, as a matter of interest both politically and also because it was a gigantic mystery story, an extraordinary a complicated story that needed to be assembled. And I approached it as an intellectual task.
Why distance yourself from that? You were so emotionally involved with the hostages.
Because if I, I've been asked this question many times, and my answer is, quite honestly, and I really mean this, that I don't think about that. Perhaps I make an effort not to think about it. That I am more interested in what was done. I don't see it as a blow to me personally. I mean, obviously, I was involved in getting the hostages free. I do feel sorry for the hostages. I mean, they're the ones that paid for this in the most obvious way, because I think the Iranians really wanted to get the hostages out of there immediately after the election, at a minimum, to hold them until after the election, but then to get rid of them so that the embargo could come off. And if the information I have is accurate, they were persuaded in the Paris meeting in October to keep them on even longer and release them to Reagan, so that the hostages' time in captivity was extended from about the end of November until the end of January. Those are the people that were hurt by it. Jimmy Carter was certainly hurt by it, though I'm not at all certain that the election would have turned out any differently. I mean, I really don't share the view that if the hostages had been released, the election would necessarily have gone to Carter. It probably would have helped him in the polls, but I don't really know whether it would have cast it the other way.
Is this anything that you would bring up with Bush or Reagan if you were in the same room with them? Would you talk to them about this?
No, I have not talked to them about it. Bush has made a number of very vigorous public statements denying that he had anything whatsoever to do with this. President Reagan has made some rather more interesting comments. He was interviewed on the golf course about, I guess it was in August, after this story had begun to circulate. And somebody asked him, you know, did your campaign conspire to keep the hostages in Iran longer? And he said, oh, no. He said, we tried the other way. And he said that three times in a row. We tried to get the hostages out. And it was kind of an odd statement. People said, you know, well, did that mean contacts with Iran? He said, oh, well, not by me. They said, well, by members of your campaign? And he said, well, I can't get into details. Some of those things are still classified. It was a peculiar statement because he seemed to be very much aware that something had gone on, that the hostages, that his campaign had done something to try to get the hostages out. What was that? You know, he didn't say, of course. The fact is that what William Casey and the others in this deal, from my point of view, they were trying to get the hostages out. They were just trying to get them out at a particular moment, and that was after Reagan became president. And I, you know, so in a sense, Reagan has commented on this in a sort of oblique way. But I don't think that either Bush or Reagan, if I had them in a room, would tell me anything that I don't already know.
My guest is Gary Sick. He was President Carter's chief aide on Iran during the Iranian hostage crisis. He's written a new book called October's Surprise. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Gary Sick is my guest, and we're talking about the research that he did in investigating the possible October surprise. What do you think that Bush and Reagan knew about this, if in fact it happened? You know, the picture that you paint, it was really Casey, who was the Reagan campaign manager at the time, who was the mastermind. Of the scheme. So do you think that Reagan and Bush would have known completely about it?
I honestly don't know. I honestly do not know. Casey, for instance, and the reason Casey's name comes up is because every single source that, you know, that has told me anything about this, that is the one thing they agree on, and that they have identified him. What did the others know? I know that after Casey came back from Madrid for the first meeting with the Iranians to talk about a deal, he arrived back on a Wednesday in Washington, and that very evening he had dinner with George Bush at the Alibi Club. That really is true. It was a perfectly named place, but they met that very night, and he had just come back from Madrid, in my view, and they went and had dinner together. Now, did they talk about Madrid, or did they just talk about the campaign and Casey not mention a single thing about what he had just been doing? I don't know the answer to that question. George Bush insists absolutely that he knew nothing about any such deal.
It must be so frustrating to you to know that Casey is dead and that you can never ask him. No one can ever ask him what really happened.
That's true. And I know, however, that there are people who are alive who know about this. They are not talking. They have not talked. And I think their inclination is never to talk. This was a covert political action. It was not intended to be discovered. And people do seal their lips on an issue like this. But there are people around who know the answers to those questions. They may not know every thought that went through Casey's mind, but if you could get all of the people involved in this to talk, they would fill in the whole story. And I think it would probably astonish us, because I think it would be far more complex than we understand. I think at the most, all I have done is just scrape off the covering of the top of the iceberg. There's much, much more. Whether we will ever get to that, I don't know. I do know, however, that if we ever get to it, it will be because you have a real investigation with subpoena power that can, I mean, there are people that were very close to Casey at the time. I can't talk to those people. They won't talk to me. They will not give me the time of day. Somebody needs to be able to ask them questions.
Well, there will be congressional investigations now. What are your expectations of these investigations?
Well, I must say that it's hard to be optimistic. The record of congressional investigations in the past few years has not exactly been overwhelming. They've dropped the ball. They've failed to pursue the right angles. They've let people get off. And there have been great confusion and uncertainty about the outcome of the thing, and it never resolved anything. So I can't hold out undue hope for what an investigation might do. On the other hand, I have the feeling that myself and the few other private individuals who have been trying to examine this story have had such I don't think we've gone as far as we can go, but we're pushing at the limits of what we can expect to accomplish without something more. And it really does need a staff. It needs people to really go take depositions, to get classified information out of the FBI, for instance, to unseal court records, which we can't get our hands on, and so forth. I think it has the potential, at least, of opening this up and letting us know a lot more about what went on.
If there was one piece of information that you could get, one question that you have that you could have answered, what would it be?
That's a very hard question. I know that for, I guess, let me give you some typical answers. One, if there was one person that I wanted to talk to, that probably would be Max Hugill, who was a real sidekick of Casey's and was with him all the time. And he appointed to be his deputy director of Central Intelligence when he came in. And he will not talk to anybody about anything. If there was one document I would want to get, it would be the documents relating to the surveillance of Cyrus Hashemi, which was imposed by the U.S. government. The Carter administration ordered it, and he was under total surveillance from October 14, 1980, until the Reagan administration lifted the surveillance on February 13, 1981. Those tapes and records of the surveillance have never been made public, and they are in the FBI files, and I think they would be absolutely fascinating to listen to and to read and to know what they said. So that would be two places that I would begin. I guess the third thing, in terms of private documents, I would love to see the appointment book of William Casey. I mean, if he wasn't in Madrid during these times, it shouldn't be that difficult to prove. This is one of the things that I've just been astonished by in this whole business. We have identified dates, places, times where we believe Casey was, and not a single individual has come forward to say, no, he wasn't there. I was with him. I saw what he was doing. Nobody.
You've made it clear that you didn't relish the role of somebody who is going to make waves and be perceived as taking on a political cause and, you know, being at the center of controversy. This was not something that appealed to you. Now that you are at the center of controversy, now that you are at the forefront of perhaps the most controversial story in, you know, recent American history, is it changing your views about anything else? Are there other things that you're starting to question that you used to feel confident about before?
I must say that having been through this experience, I find myself being far more skeptical about government pronouncements, about the apparent, you know, role that, that government figures play and things that they do, of questioning statements, questioning policies, and perhaps being more prepared to believe the worst instead of the best of our political leaders. That I come out of a small town in Kansas. I grew up in sort of non-political background, and basically grew up with those fundamental civics class ideals that, that basically people do the best they can, that when they tell you something, they mean it, that you basically can trust people and be open with them. A lot of those, perhaps foolish, but nevertheless pleasant values, I find being challenged myself. I find that it's harder and harder for me to subscribe to that, and I see myself, I guess, becoming more cynical.
I have one last question. What's the next step for you? You know, you've been researching this for years. You went public with it on April 15th in your New York Times op-ed piece. Now your book has come out. The whole country's talking about the subject. What's the next step for you?
I think I'd like to take a vacation.
And after that? I mean, you're not going to give up on this story.
Oh, no, no, no. I think, actually, I'm certainly going to... My wife tells me that she thinks this has become a lifetime profession, and I tell her that's absolutely wrong, that this is not going to be something I do the rest of my life. On the other hand, it's a story that I'm probably never going to be able to walk away from entirely, and it depends really on what happens next. If the Congress does an investigation and finds out an answer, whatever it is, that will put an end to it. If there are things that could happen that would say, okay, you put this aside. I don't want to make this a lifetime profession. I do think that it's that I've done a lot, and I've made a contribution here, and people can like it or dislike it. They can agree with it or disagree with it, but it seems to me that it really is time for the professionals to take over and let us amateurs step into the background, and then I'll have to figure out where I go from there.
Gary Sick, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, as always.
Gary Sick has written a new book called October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. News today from Yugoslavia, from Iraqi Kurdistan, from Los Angeles, and a new presidential poll which finds that President Bush, when matched against an unnamed Democratic candidate, barely wins nowadays among voters who are sampled. But when you then name a candidate like Mario Cuomo, at this point he wins by quite a bit. We'll also be hearing the third and final story in Michael Scholar's series on nuclear waste, attempts to find some permanent site for disposing of nuclear waste. And also a talk with one of your favorites, Art Spiegelman, the author of the cartoon novel of the Nazi Holocaust, Mouse, and now Mouse 2.
I look forward to hearing it. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When a writer works on a novel for close to 30 years, you start to wonder, is the novelist suffering from writer's block or incubating a masterpiece? There's been a lot of speculation over the years about Harold Brodkey's novel in progress. Until now, his literary reputation has been based on two collections of short stories. Now that the novel has just been published, the judgments are coming in. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of Brodkey's new novel, The Runaway Soul.
The reviews I've seen so far of Harold Brodkey's enormous novel are regrettably casual, if not exactly dismissive. We've been waiting for Brodkey for 27 years, and for almost as long we've been told that he's an American Proust. This builds up resentment. And then there are all these 835 pages. We ask ourselves if we really want to know that much about Wiley, a 60-year-old writer, looking back at his orphanhood, his adoptive parents, his crazy half-sister, his gay cousins, Harvard and Manhattan, sexuality and death. We get tired of hearing how smart Wiley is, how self-aware. The prose itself, sometimes exalted, often ugly, slows us down. It insists on its strategies and evasions, everything that's problematic. Haven't we already had more than enough already of fiction as epistemology? Why should we care if or whom Wiley loves or Wiley forgives? Well, I think we'll remember the characters in The Runaway Soul long after we've forgotten most of the people we meet in modern novels, simply because we experience them in Brodkey's pages with a greater intensity and qualm. They are thought to death, but we hear them anyway. His ear is remarkable. I also think Runaway Soul is the ultimate 50s novel of dysfunctional families, soulless suburbs, sexual confusion, humorless psychologizing, existential narcissism, and arty mythomania. Think of Wiley as Zooey. It's just that Harold Brodkey has finally published his ultimate 50s novel, and J.D. Salinger won't. It seems to me, too, that what worries Wiley and Brodkey is worth brooding about. Again and again, we're told in this novel that feelings don't fit into any grammatical or syntactical model, that ideas dissipate their reality in moments, that moments can't be reliably recaptured, that memory, like a dragonfly, flits away, that time, beautiful, powerful, dreadful, fluctuates, and we can't get anywhere in it, we dissolve, that the mind would like to be an animal, that identity is raw and intrusive, that guilt is complicated, and so is blame, that knowledge, moist and dark, slippery and eel-like, shivers and shimmers and changes, that dreams, experiments in grammar, are too self-centered for language, that language is inadequate to consciousness, and that consciousness itself is not the real world, or certainly not all of it. And so Brodkey's prose submits itself to an interrogation, seeking to live in the present tense. It resorts to ellipses and italics and parentheses, hyphens and dashes. It says thing and stuff a lot, as well as sort of and in a way. It turns nouns into eyesore adverbs. I'm reminded not so much of Henry James or even Jean Genet as of Heidegger in Being and Time and of Sartre in Being and Nothingness. This is about as serious as you can get, as if consciousness were a disease. Like the crybaby 50s, it omits world politics, ignores most of society and our larger institutions, is not at all curious about food or other countries, blames Dad for almost everything, needs Elvis and the Beats and some laughs, and forgives itself, perhaps too easily. What isn't so 50s is its contemplation of androgyny, and it is mysteriously lightweight on the matter of Wiley's Jewishness. What are we left with? A remarkable beast, brilliant and wounded, hungry for meaning, the way we were.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Runaway Soul by Harold Brodkey. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Life and the Sex Pistols, England's most famous and infamous punk band. We talk with Glenn Matlock, the founding bass player, who co-wrote many of the Pistols songs, including this one. He left the band, he says, because it was becoming too much like the Monkees. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. God save the Queen!